From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Lieutenant Colonel Martha McSally. She's the highest-ranking female fighter pilot in the Air Force, but last year, when she was stationed in Saudi Arabia, she was not allowed to drive a car off the base. She also had to wear a full-body veil and be escorted by a man when she left the base. These were military regulations in keeping with Saudi restrictions on women's behavior. She challenged these regulations in a lawsuit that she filed against the Defense Department last month. This month, the military changed one of those regulations. The body veil is no longer mandatory, but it is still strongly encouraged. We'll hear from Colonel McSally, her lawyer John Whitehead, and get a response from the U.S. Central Command. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Controller General David Walker told congressional leaders today that the General Accounting Office will sue Vice President Dick Cheney for access to records of the task force that wrote the administration's energy policy. It's the first time in its 80-year history that the GAO has sued a federal official to obtain information. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
The GAO and some congressional committees want to know which lobbyists and interest groups met with Cheney's energy task force. Last weekend, the administration went on a counteroffensive. Cheney told a Sunday talk show that Walker had backed off until Democrats re-energized the issue. Walker, a Republican, says he only paused out of prudence after the terrorist attacks. He says the GAO tried repeatedly to reach a reasoned and reasonable accommodation with the White House. Meanwhile, Democratic Congressman John Dingell and Henry Waxman upped the political ante. In a letter to Cheney, they compare this to 10 cases in which Republican Congresses got similar information while investigating alleged Clinton administration scandals. They argue that Cheney now wants to make the White House virtually immune from congressional oversight. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
After cutting interest rates 11 times in a row last year, the Federal Reserve has decided to leave a key interest rate unchanged. Policymakers at the central bank concluded their two-day meeting with an announcement that the outlook for economic recovery has become more promising. The statement noted that there are more signs that consumer demand is increasing and economic activity is beginning to firm up. The federal funds rate remains at 1.75%, its lowest level in 40 years. President Bush has begun a three-state tour promoting his plans for homeland security and his economic stimulus package. His first stop was North Carolina. Larry Schooler reports from member station WFDD.
The president spoke to more than 6,000 supporters at the Veterans Memorial Coliseum in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. The invited guests included Republican Elizabeth Dole, and the president made a veiled endorsement of Dole's Senate campaign, saying he hopes to dine with her more often in Washington. Bush also explained his plan for finding people more jobs, saying the U.S. should make good use of its strong agriculture production.
If we're the best at something, it seems like we ought to sell it. The more we can sell, the more jobs there are, the more markets that open for U.S. producers, the more jobs there will be for U.S. workers.
That's a position that's been vociferously challenged by several elected officials in this state who believe free trade has nearly destroyed the textile industry. For NPR News, I'm Larry Schooler in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 144 points, or 1.5%, to close at 9,762 in very heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 20 points to close at 1,913. The S&P 500 gained 13. This is NPR News. The U.S. military in Afghanistan is investigating claims that Special Forces soldiers killed and captured some fighters loyal to the Afghan government in a raid on a big ammunition dump last week. At first, U.S. officials insisted the captured compound was a Taliban hideout, but Afghan leaders in the area said the men inside supported the new government and were collecting weapons to be turned over to the authorities. Pieces of a 7,000-pound NASA satellite could come crashing to Earth just before midnight. The spacecraft, called the Extreme Ultraviolet Explorer, is expected to burn up in the atmosphere. Pat Duggins reports from member station WMFE.
Most of the extreme ultraviolet Explorer is expected to incinerate high in orbit, but NASA thinks 9 chunks of the satellite, made of stainless steel and titanium, could survive and fall to Earth. The fiery finish to the spacecraft's mission to study faraway sources of ultraviolet light isn't expected to cause any danger. Mission managers think the parts will rain down in an unpopulated area of the South Pacific. The robot observatory was launched in 1992 with 3 telescopes and a spectrometer designed to study ultraviolet light outside of the solar system. The spacecraft lasted in orbit twice as long as planned. 2 space shuttle missions carried ultraviolet telescopes on flights called Astro 1 and 2, but the Extreme Ultraviolet Explorer enabled scientists to study more than 1,000 sources of UV energy for 8 years. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
A terminal at San Francisco International Airport was shut down for more than 2 hours this morning after security guards lost track of a man who'd been found to have traces of explosive residue on his shoes. Security guards discovered what appeared to be the residue on the shoes of a traveler but failed to stop him from disappearing into the crowd. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lieutenant Colonel Martha McSally, filed a lawsuit against the Defense Department last month, challenging its regulations requiring female military personnel in Saudi Arabia to adhere to certain Islamic customs when they leave their military base. Commander McSally was stationed in Saudi Arabia from November of 2000 to December 2001. Anytime she left the base, she had to wear the full body veil, known as the abaya. She had to be escorted by a male. She was not allowed to drive a vehicle, and when she was in one, she had to sit in the back seat. These are the regulations that she's challenged. Earlier this month, the military eased one of those regulations. It's no longer mandatory that women wear the body veil off base. But the new order from General Tommy Frank says it is, quote, strongly encouraged. Colonel McSally is the Air Force's highest-ranking female fighter pilot. She was one of the first 7 women trained as a fighter pilot. I spoke with her yesterday. We'll hear from her lawyer and a military spokesperson a little later. Colonel McSally told me that she's been trying to change the regulations for military women in Saudi Arabia since 1995 and filed her suit only after protesting within the chain of command. Initially, she was working on behalf of other women. She thought it was ironic when she was assigned to the Saudi military base.
I did speak with the commander prior to being assigned over there, and I explained to him my strong conviction from an obligation as an officer and as a Christian I believe this was not a lawful order, and I was going to try and encourage a change in the policy from the inside, and that I hoped he could honor my personal conviction that I just could never put the abaya on myself. And I told him I would not go off base at all for leisure while I was on my 1-year assignment over there. And I wasn't sure if I was going to be told or ordered to go off base to do my job, but I just could never put the abaya on. Well, 3 days prior to my departure for Saudi Arabia, my whole house is packed up, my dog and car with my brothers. I have 2 green duffel bags to my name, and I'm heading out to overseas for a 1-year remote assignment. And I get told by a friend of mine who's a chaplain serving in Saudi Arabia that, in fact, I was going to be forced to wear the abaya immediately upon arrival, that I was going to land at one base and I was going to have to travel to another base, and they were going to force me to sit in the back seat and put this Muslim outfit on. And I couldn't believe it was applied that extensively, but I sent an email over to the commander's chief of staff explaining, reminding them of the conversation I had with the general about my conviction and that I would be wearing very loose-fitting Western clothing, conservative clothing. And now 2 days prior to my departure, I received emails from the chief of staff and the judge advocate threatening that I would be court-martialed if I didn't follow this order. So I was put in this position immediately before I even arrived to my assignment to follow an order or follow my conviction as an officer and a Christian.
So what did you do?
Well, I initially decided that I was going to disobey it. And I was going to accept the court-martial, and I was going to hopefully have that as a venue to bring about a change in the policy at obviously great personal cost to myself. But a conviction is a conviction. And So I decided to do that, and I went to tell my current commander. Now on Monday, I was leaving Tuesday night, so I asked for an appointment with him and went to meet with him to tell him that I was about to torch myself over this conviction in the hope that I could bring about a change to the policy. And he eloquently urged me in a very long meeting to abide by the policy one time. He said, "Just you need to just get to the base. You got to get on the inside. They've got to see you as an officer and a warrior and a fighter pilot, and then you can bring about a change from the inside. If you're hoping to change a policy, you're never going to do it by refusing to wear it. You're just going to be punished. You'll be out of the Air Force. That'll be the end of you, and the policy will never change. You have a unique opportunity. You know, you should take it." So, I left his office and I agonized. I mean, this was a couple of long, sleepless nights of thinking and praying, talking to some mentors. I mean, I had no idea it was going to come to this place after all these years.
So what did you do? Did you wear it on the way to the base?
I decided to, against my gut feeling, take his advice. So I flew into Prince Sultan Air Base, Saudi Arabia, in the middle of the night. And I was briefed by a young enlisted man that I had to sit in the back of the car and put on this whole outfit. And I got into a car. I was the highest ranking person there, sat in the back seat, put on the abaya and the abaya scarf. And now we are traveling in the middle of the night in a suburban with dark tinted windows with a bunch of American military men in short hair and collared shirts and jeans. Traveling from this one base to the other. And I realized then, from my own personal experience, that that not only was the policy wrong, but it was just completely irrational and unnecessary. So that was my first experience. And I thought, well, just wear it one time and I can bring about a change. Well, that didn't happen. They kept forcing me to leave the base to do my job, putting me in a position, you know, to say, well, this is a leadership issue. You've got to go, you know, do this and this to do your job. So on several occasions, I was put in this dilemma to follow my faith and my oath of office or follow this order.
And each time you put on the full body veil when you needed to.
For the first month, I, when asked to go do different functions, I sent my deputy and I sent other people who worked for me. I delegated. And I just thought, well, let me just get my feet on the ground and get established here and get a reputation, and then perhaps I can bring this up. Because, I mean, the policy could have changed so quickly and so easily and no one would have noticed. If I was wearing American clothes in that car in the middle of the night, nobody would have noticed. So I asked to meet with the general after 1 month there. And, you know, I asked him to change the policy immediately for situations like I just mentioned. Yeah, travel to and from different bases and going to the international airport and going to the Royal Saudi Air Force headquarters to do briefings. Certainly I shouldn't wear an abaya. I should be wearing my U.S. uniform if I'm going to give a briefing as an American officer. And so I asked if he would immediately change it for those situations. And then work with whoever to change it for women going off base for leisure, but it was he could have changed them all. It was at his level, legal authority wise, to change them, and at that point I was told by the judge advocate and the chief of staff and the general, it's not going to change. You know, the risk outweighs the benefit. You're the only one who cares about it. You know, get out of here. Don't bring this up again. It's over. And this was 1 month into my 12 months there.
What impact did you feel like it had on your authority when you were the highest ranking person in the car, but you had to wear the abaya, the full body veil, and sit in the back seat?
Well, it clearly confuses what we hold dear in the military, which is a clear line of authority. Everyone knows who's above who and who's below who. And we have to be able to snap orders out in a moment's notice, and everyone has to respect that authority. Also, we pride ourselves on doing the mission by having unit cohesion. Everyone is treated the same. Even if we're all, you know, sucking it up with horrible conditions, excuse my slang, then we're all doing it together, and you don't separate people and treat them differently. So you know, it certainly is confusing for, you know, young men to, on the one hand, be taking orders from a woman. On the other hand, you know, they're driving me around when I can't drive and I have to sit in the back and put on this demeaning and humiliating outfit. So, it clearly confuses our basic military tenets when we impose policies like this on our gals.
Let me read from some of the military dress requirements for the base in Saudi Arabia. It says that you can't wear civilian attire that may be offensive to the host nation. This includes items of clothing with holes or pictures and writings that are offensive to local standards of decency. For example, alcohol slogans or advertisements, pictures of bodies not fully covered, etc. Men will wear civilian shirts with collars and hemmed sleeves. Shirts will not be unbuttoned below the collarbone, and shirts with tails will be tucked in. Wear pants that are full length. Jeans may be worn that are not ragged or torn. Can't wear earrings. All tattoos may be offensive, particularly unclothed women. Religious symbols will be concealed. So men are allowed to wear shirts and even jeans, as long as the jeans are not, you know, don't have any holes in them.
Well, the amazing thing there is another paragraph in that regulation that prohibits men from wearing any local customary clothing.
Let me read that. It says, men shall not wear host nation attire such as the thobe or long robe and the gutra or headdress. What is the thobe? That is the long robe?
It's the traditional long white robe that the men wear, and then the gutra is the headdress.
What's your understanding of the reason why men are not allowed to wear the traditional Saudi dress, while women, until very recently, were required to wear the Saudi dress?
Actually, I don't have a very good understanding because it seems irrational to me, but what I've been told is that the local people would be offended by our American military men wearing their local clothing, especially if they don't wear it correctly. And that, again, the Saudis are not asking our women to wear the abaya and the abaya scarf, so I'm not really sure where that inconsistency came from. It's one of the irrational portions of this policy that has caused me to try and bring about a change.
Were there many other women on the base in Saudi Arabia when you were stationed there?
Yes. There were. I can't give you the exact number, but there's several hundred.
And what percentage would you say sided with you on challenging these regulations?
Well, I didn't take an official poll, but I can say anecdote-wise, I had several women who worked for me, worked around me, showed tremendous amount of support, and I've even still continued to receive emails from women in uniform. For trying to bring about this change.
And what about the men on the base? Did a lot of men agree with your challenges?
Actually, a lot of them did. Again, a lot of the men who worked for me and worked around me, and some who were senior ranking to me, would pull me aside, of course, quietly and say, you know, you're doing the right thing, you know, for America and for your faith and for your oath of office, and we're behind you. So there were a great number of men who were supportive of me. There were also, you know, those who didn't understand at all because, quite frankly, it didn't apply to them. And so they thought, what's the big deal? You know, just put the thing on. You know, is it hurting you to put it on? And, you know, I would say, well, it didn't hurt Rosa Parks to sit in the back of the bus either, but that's not the criteria we use for whether something's right or wrong. So there definitely were some people, not necessarily, you know, by gender, above me that were very upset with me. Talking me out of my conviction and telling me that my choices and my actions in this matter were disloyal and unprofessional and I was exuding poor leadership, all these things that they promoted me early for in the past, I all of a sudden didn't have anymore because I was raising this issue and drawing a line in the sand saying this is unconstitutional, it's un-American, and it's got to change.
My guest is Lieutenant Colonel Martha McSally. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Lieutenant Colonel Martha McSally. She's suing the Defense Department over regulations that restrict the behavior of American military women in Saudi Arabia when they leave the base. One of the restrictions, wearing the full body veil known as the abaya, was eased this month. The abaya is no longer mandatory off base, but it is still, quote, strongly encouraged. Colonel, why do you object to wearing the abaya? And I should say that, you know, a lot of women journalists who've had to, for example, who've had to cover stories in Saudi Arabia and in other Muslim countries have worn the body veil when they've had to, in order to get the interview. Do you know what I mean? And in a way, it's like going undercover, but doing what you have to do to get the job done. But for you, that seemed really inappropriate. Why did you object so much to wearing the abaya, so much so that you put your career in the military on the line for it?
Well, yeah. First of all, for myself, again, I'm a follower of Christ, and my Christian faith is the centerpiece of who I am. And to be forced to put on the garment of a religion that I do not believe in and a faith I do not follow, to me, was unacceptable. Secondly, I, not just me, but the women who this affects, the officers and enlisted serving over there, we are putting our lives on the line to serve our nation. And we are over in Saudi Arabia as officials of the United States government, the United States military, doing a mission over there alongside the men. And the dynamics that I tried to explain earlier, aside from the religious issue, is wearing the abaya and the abaya headscarf, sitting in the back seat, not being able to drive, and having your subordinates have to claim you as their, you know, as his wife as opposed to his supervisor, is so demeaning and so humiliating. To treat just some of our people in that way, for reasons that I still haven't been able to get a very solid answer on, is unacceptable.
What about other Western women in Saudi Arabia? Women working for the State Department, or the wives and daughters of male diplomats who are based there? Do they have to wear...
Yeah, that was the amazing thing I discovered once I started looking into this 7 years ago now, is I was told initially when I asked, I heard about the policy, I saw a picture of an American woman wearing an abaya, and I got a copy of the regulation. I just couldn't believe our women in Saudi Arabia were being forced to wear this. So I started to do some research, and when I asked some basic questions, who's responsible for this policy, when did it come into effect, where did it come from, and why, the answers I got were very vague. Well, it's way above our pay grade. It's a State Department issue. It's a host nation thing. These are the kind of things I was told. And, you know, when I looked into it, I realized, you know, not only was it not imposed by the State Department, but State Department women working over there are told they can't wear the abaya when they're doing official government business because they're representatives of the United States government, and they are not forced to wear it during their leisure time. Madeleine Albright goes over to Riyadh. She certainly isn't going to wear an abaya. That undermines her authority. And so then I found out that, you know, friends of mine who were, you know, co-workers of mine, male military members, were getting stationed over there, and their wives were not forced to wear the abaya, but I was. So very inconsistent. It appeared when it came down to it that the Saudis weren't asking for it. The State Department wasn't asking for it. The American military was somehow doing this to itself.
Have you ever asked yourself what the military reaction would be if men had to dress in Saudi garb?
In fact, I've tried to paint that word picture for people, you know, as I've responded to this, is I think that there would be, you know, an uprising if our men had to, you know, grow beards and put on the local customary clothing just to, you know, get along or blend in or whatever the reasons are that I've heard that women have to do it. You know, especially, you know, I'm a fighter pilot, and we tend to have a in-your-face, you know, type A personality that's, you know, raises issues and confronts them when they're not sensical. And so I'm responding to it in the same way that any of them would respond to, you know, men being treated in that way.
I'm wondering, when you talk to your military commanders about why the regulation was in place about wearing the abaya, the body veil, were you told that this was about respect for cultural differences, or were you told that it was fear that we would alienate the Saudis if women were more exposed?
Actually, I was told many different things over the years. The first thing I was told back in 1995 was it was for, quote, host nation sensitivities. And that one stuck for a while. And as I then found the paperwork that said the Saudis were not asking non-Muslim women to wear the abaya and the abaya scarf, and that State Department women and other European women, you know, Western women, were not wearing the abaya and abaya scarf, I brought that to their attention. And then just recently, as I was in this dilemma as to whether to abide by it myself, the issue or the reasoning I was given was forced protection. We have to protect our troops from terrorist attacks, so we have to blend in like never before. I was, in fact, in those emails that I referenced earlier that went back and forth in my few days prior to arrival, I was told things like, you wouldn't want to put the young enlisted transportation personnel's lives in danger because of your crusade. So they paint this picture that should I not wear an abaya, somehow I'm, you know, inviting a terrorist attack on our people by not blending in. As I would then come back and say, help me out here. We've got a bunch of clearly American military men wearing jeans and collared shirts with American military women, you know, wearing the abaya and the abaya headscarf. We are not blending in. We look like American military men with American military women wearing abayas. Or even worse, we look like American military men with a local woman, which would cause a tremendous amount of offense. So, you know, this whole idea that we would blend in to avoid a terrorist attack, that the terrorists would have, you know, our car in their sights, and then they would, you know, perhaps see a woman in an abaya and go, oh, it must not be Americans, is just ludicrous. And when I pointed that out to them, the next argument was, oh, okay, we need to protect our women from harassment downtown. And again, I pointed out that that was irrational because most of the women I talked to who wore abayas downtown were harassed. You know, the local religious police would come and correct how they were wearing it because they clearly were under their jurisdiction. When you put that outfit on, you're inviting yourself, you know, to be under the jurisdiction of the locals and have them correct the way you wear it. Whereas I talked to State Department women who never wore the abaya and never got harassed. So that's a myth as well, I think. I think, you know, you randomly are going to get harassed downtown. And to be treating our female service members like property in order to protect somehow some people in an allied nation from terrorizing them certainly isn't the ultimate solution that I would come up with if I was in charge.
We'll hear more about Lieutenant Colonel Martha McSally's lawsuit against the Defense Department in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Lieutenant Colonel Martha McSally about her suit against the Defense Department, talk with her lawyer, John Whitehead, and get a response from Commander Ernest Duplessis. Also, Ken Tucker reviews a CD that's a hit in England and is about to be released in the States. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lieutenant Colonel Martha McSally, the first woman in U.S. military history to fly a fighter aircraft in a combat mission. Now she's suing the Defense Department, challenging regulations that restrict the behavior of female military personnel in Saudi Arabia when they travel off base. When she was in Saudi Arabia last year, any time she left the base, she had to wear a full body veil and be escorted by a male. She wasn't allowed to drive off base, and when she was in a vehicle, she had to be in the back seat. These are the regulations she's challenged. One regulation was eased this month. The military no longer requires the body veil, but women are, quote, strongly encouraged to wear it off base. My guests are Colonel McSally and her lawyer, John Whitehead, of the Rutherford Institute, which also represented Paula Jones in her suit against President Clinton. Let me just start with this question. Colonel, why did you decide to actually sue?
Well, I came to that decision, again, after over 6 years of trying to bring about a change to this policy, these policies from the inside, after about a year of bringing it up with the current chain of command that was over there, after 8 months of abiding by this policy myself, after 4 months of a promised policy review to take this seriously, after five senators wrote to the Secretary of Defense about it, I waited and I waited and I waited for a change. And in August, I decided that I would let the third branch of the government take a look at it and hopefully bring about a change from the outside. The Rutherford Institute contacted me in April following a USA Today article that came out offering their legal assistance, and we stayed in contact, but waited for those 4 months thinking that perhaps the policy would be changed unilaterally since there was a policy review going on. And I keep asking, what's the status of the policy review? April, May, June, July, August, and it wasn't going to come out anytime soon. So I decided in August, I told them in August, hey, I'm going to file this lawsuit in 2 weeks. So if there was going to be a policy review that was going to come out, now would be a very good time for it to come out so we could avoid all this. And then we delayed it till December because September 11th happened, and obviously our nation was grieving and our military mission was very focused. But I filed it right before I left.
John Whitehead, why did you want to take on the suit?
Well, we thought there was, you know, of course, very important constitutional issues, and in our lawsuit, we allege a number of things, and there are three First Amendment claims. One is the freedom of religion claim. We feel that by forcing Colonel McSally to wear a religious outfit, which is the abaya, it's required by Islamic law for women to wear in Saudi Arabia, and for her to have to wear that and pretend she's Islamic, which, of course, violates her religious freedom as a Christian. Also, by wearing the abaya, it really forces her to give a message or violate her free speech. It forces her to speak. And what it really says is what the abaya symbolizes is that women are the property of men. And it's forcing her to say, yes, I agree with this principle that women are the property of men. Of course, she objects to that. Another key claim in the First Amendment is based on our church-state clause, the Establishment Clause, and by the government purchasing the abaya, the military purchasing the abaya and forcing women to wear it, we feel it's establishing a religion and violates our church-state clause. And also there is a cause of action under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which says that if the government in any way violates a person's religious freedom, they have to show that they have a compelling state interest to do so. And even if they can show a compelling state interest, they have to show that they can accomplish it by the least restrictive means possible. Then the other claim is our Fifth Amendment claim, which is that this is gender discrimination, that obviously, and from what we've heard, it's very clear that women are treated differently than men and discriminated against, and therefore it's a violation of the Fifth Amendment of our Constitution.
Earlier this month, General Tommy Franks issued a new directive about the abaya, and this directs local commanders to revise policies to reflect that wearing the full body veil is not mandatory, but it is strongly encouraged. I'd like to know how you each interpret strongly encouraged. Colonel?
Well, in a military environment, a strongly encouraged statement by a four-star general to a young enlisted woman can easily be construed as an order. I mean, I've been in several situations where I was strongly encouraged to do something, and that was essentially a code word that we all better be there or do whatever they were talking about. So, you know, this language to me is troubling because I would hope that, number one, the abaya would truly be optional, that a woman would feel free to make an informed choice, which is a whole other issue, to get the right information, to make an informed choice as to whether she wants to wear it or not, and that nobody would be coercing her even subtly, even her immediate supervisor. You know, you land in a strange country, you're greeted by someone higher ranking than you, and they say, well, you don't have to wear this, but you're strongly encouraged to. And, oh, by the way, if you do, you'll probably be safer. I mean, this is the kind of things that, I've seen, you know, I would envision would go on. So that looks like an order with different terminology attached to it. You know, secondly, how do we guarantee that in 6 months' time someone doesn't come right back and make it mandatory again? So I have a hard time with you know, guaranteeing that and saying this is acceptable. And lastly, I mean, the strongly encouraged language in no way addresses how demeaning and humiliating wearing this thing is. So I'm very concerned about that language.
John Whitehead, as the lawyer in this suit, how do you interpret the strongly encouraged? Do you see that as a victory?
Well, I don't see it as a victory. I think it's a move in the right direction. I think that keeping equivocal language in any kind of order, as the colonel says, is can create all kinds of problems of coercion.
John Whitehead, what happens to the lawsuit now? One of the three things that you're challenging has been amended.
It has been amended, and how it affects the lawsuit, that's going to be, you know, for the judge to decide. We will know the government's answer sometimes in March, how they're going to respond to it. You know, something could happen in between then. Maybe favorably so. We don't know, but the lawsuit moves forward. I think that by moving as much as they have, by saying that it's no longer mandatory, really reduces the fact that they have a compelling state interest to violate any of her First Amendment rights. So I think that it has affected the lawsuit, and hopefully we can drive this thing home and win it.
Now, the Defense Department says that its easing of the ruling about military women having to wear the abaya in Saudi Arabia is not a direct response to your suit, that they made that ruling independent of your suit. Do you buy that?
Well, the timing does seem interesting, but to be honest with you, I don't really care what brings about the change or what the driving factors are. I mean, I just want the policies to be changed. So whatever reasons are attached to it is really not a factor to me.
My guests are Lieutenant Colonel Martha McSally, who is suing the Defense Department, and her lawyer John Whitehead of the Rutherford Institute. Colonel McSally will be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lieutenant Colonel Martha McSally. You were based in Saudi Arabia from November of 2000 to December of 2001. You're now based in Tucson, Arizona. Can you talk a little bit about the difference of being based in a place where you can dress like yourself when you leave the base? You mm-hmm. can leave the base. You can drive. You can leave unescorted by a male.
Yeah, well, I love America, and that's why I chose to raise my right hand to defend it. And it's great to be back in America, and I can't tell you how strongly I feel that way after this last 13-month tour over in Saudi Arabia and all that was going on. My new assignment seems to be a breath of fresh air as far as the environment that I'm working in the support that I'm receiving, the welcoming that I'm receiving. I've only been there a few days, but it's been a breath of fresh air for me. That combined with the fact that I'm in America, I drive home in my car, and I'm consistently treated based on my performance and my rank.
Let me back up a little earlier in your career. You were among the first 7 women trained as a fighter pilot in the American military. What year was this that you were trained?
Well, the Department of Defense changed its policy that restricted women from flying combat aircraft in 1993. This was following Congress repealing the law that restricted women from flying combat aircraft right after Desert Storm. So I thought the policy was going to change when Congress repealed the law and picked an assignment as an instructor pilot to keep the dream alive and buy myself some time for hope that the DOD would change its policy. So in 1993, I was told that the policy was changed, and 7 of us had earned fighters out of pilot training but were not allowed to fly them because of the policy. They went back and said, you earned it, you're going to get it. So in 1994, I went off to train in the A-10 Warthog.
Why did you want to be a fighter pilot?
Well, a lot of the reason was because they told me that I couldn't, to be honest with you. I mean, I was at the Air Force Academy as a cadet, eating dirt, crawling through the mud, going side by side through the tremendous strenuous environment academically and militarily. And, we'd all graduate and meet the same criteria and go off to pilot training. Again, women would graduate high in their class, and the men below them in the order of merit would go off to fly fighters for years. We had women very qualified to fly fighters, and they were just not able to because of the policy. So, part of what motivated me was the fact that we couldn't, and I just went, well, we're gonna someday, and I'm gonna be one of them. Being in the Air Force, obviously flying a fighter or bomber is, you're at the pointy end of the spear, like we say. I mean, you are out there literally putting your life on the line for the mission, and it's a very challenging and very rewarding profession.
Are there any things that you found weren't adapted to women in the military, or particularly in the program for fighter pilots?
No, our transition, though, was, one where there were some people who weren't real happy about women showing up in the squadron. So, I mean, we really all just had to kind of hunker down and show our competence and our capability as pilots. I mean, you put your helmet on and nobody can tell whether you're a man or a woman. The bottom line is, how do you fly the jet? And so, there was a time there where you just had to go, okay, well, I'm not, listening to some of the outside, voices here. I'm just pressing on and proving through my competence that I belong to be a mission-ready combat pilot in the squadron. And for me, I was very quickly accepted based on that. We deployed over to Kuwait almost immediately after I became mission-ready. And so now I'm over with my unit, and we're in a tight environment, and we're... we're doing a real mission, and every day you could be a POW. So no one's going to have you fly in their wing if you're not capable, ready to help protect each other and do the mission.
You were the first woman to fly a combat sortie in a fighter jet. Would you briefly describe that mission for us?
Well, again, I just brand new in the A-10. I had just gotten checked out and said I was mission ready. We deployed immediately over to Kuwait to enforce the no-fly zone out of Iraq. So I've only been flying the A-10 for about 5 months. And, all of a sudden I'm taking off to go fly into Iraq and, help deter them from coming south and from having any aggression against their own people. And at any given moment, you could lose your engines or be shot down. And even though it's a strange kind of war we have going on there, you could easily be a POW. So when you cross that border, I mean, it's real. I mean, I remember looking down and crossing that border from Kuwait into Iraq and saying, well, I hope I was paying attention in class because, this matters now. And the reality is that you do what you train for. I mean, I had some hairy missions where I was, locked up by Iraqi radars and things. But you just do what you train for and, you look out for each other and you come back safely, God willing.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Colonel Martha McSally is suing the Defense Department over regulations that require American military women in Saudi Arabia when they leave the base to conform to several Saudi restrictions on women's dress and behavior. One of those restrictions was eased this month. Military women are no longer required to wear the full body veil, the abaya, when they leave the base. But according to General Tommy Frank's new order, women are, quote, strongly encouraged to wear it. We called the Defense Department for a response, and they referred us to U.S. Central Command, which referred us to Commander Ernest Duplessis. He declined to comment on the lawsuit and kept his remarks to this month's policy change on the abaya. I asked him about the wording, which says women are strongly encouraged to wear the abaya. What does strongly encouraged mean?
It means just that. It means that one of the reasons why the abaya is strongly encouraged is for force protection concerns. When we can help our military personnel to have a lower profile and blend in with the local community, that lessens their profile and hence we believe does not make them as big a target. And so for force protection concerns primarily, that's one of the reasons why the abaya is strongly encouraged to be worn.
But a woman off base has to be escorted by a male. Now, the military male is allowed to wear jeans as long as they're, you know, in good shape and there aren't holes in them. So if you have an American military man wearing jeans and a shirt escorting a woman in a full body veil, is that helping her fit in at all? She's clearly with an American military man.
The other side of the concerns with the abaya wear go to the local customs as well as the host nation sensitivities. And so that is something that plays into the equation as well. And that is the standard wear for women in that area of the world.
Now, why was the original directive saying that military women had to wear the abaya off base? Why was that scaled down to that it was strongly encouraged that they wear it?
Well, General Tommy Franks, who's the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Central Command, recently directed that the local commanders revise this existing policy, as you know, to reflect the wear of the abaya as not being mandatory but strongly encouraged, and that would remove any requirements to wear that particular garment there, but we still have our force protection concerns, and so we want to make those known to our service members and then provide them with that ability to balance those and make those decisions that they have to make.
How does the military respond to Colonel McSally's concern that if she or any other female member of the American military has to wear the body veil and practice other Islamic customs, that they are functionally being subservient to people who they are actually superior to in the line of command?
Well, as you
know, it undermines their authority.
Lieutenant Colonel McSally presently has litigation pending with the Department of Defense, and so it is our policy that while there is pending litigation, really not to comment on any of the issues involved in that litigation.
Is there anything else that you feel you can say about the issue or about the lawsuit?
No. Well, the lawsuit is with the Department of Defense. That's certainly out of our purview. And I think that we've clearly stated what the revision to the policy is and what that means. And we believe that it's in all the best interest that the policy is suitable for the host nation as well as for our service members.
How do you deal with the paradox that faced Colonel McSally when she was in Saudi Arabia? On the one hand, she was a fighter pilot. She could fly missions. And on the other hand, she couldn't drive a car and had to wear a full body veil when leaving the base.
Once again, this is all part of the pending litigation that is going on at the Department of Defense level, and so I'm really not at liberty to discuss any of those issues.
Was the toning down of the regulation about the full body veil, the abaya, a direct result of Colonel McSally's suit?
No.
It was independent of that? What inspired it then?
Once again, our regulations are periodically reviewed. This is one of those regulations that was under review. It's strongly encouraged due to force protection concerns, and the commanders there will implement the measures to mitigate those concerns.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us, Commander.
You're more than welcome.
Commander Ernest Duplessis of the U.S. Central Command in Tampa, Florida. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a CD that's a hit in England and is about to be released here. This is Fresh Air. Super Furry Animals are a Welsh quintet who are major stars in Britain and a solid cult act in America. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews their new album called Rings Around the World. It's a hit in Britain and will be released here in March.
Super Furry Animals didn't exactly travel rings around the world in recording their new CD. They did do some journeying. The quintet began recording in their native Wales, but also did much of the work you hear on this album at studios in Woodstock, New York, a legendary music site since Bob Dylan and the band cut songs there 3 decades ago. Why bring this up? Because there's an obsession with things American in Super Furry Animals' music and their thoughts. In their jangly guitars, you can hear echoes of the Birds. In their massed harmonies, the Beach Boys. And they've gone on record in the press as saying that the deceptively pretty tune, No Sympathy, with its refrain, No Sympathy, You Deserve to Die, was inspired by a pre-September 11th contempt for George Bush's attitude toward the death penalty in his home state of Texas.
I have no sympathy for
Another song, which became a hit single in Europe, called Juxtaposed With You, features a creamy melody that wouldn't be out of place in the discography of Burt Bacharach, even as Super Furry Animal Gruff Reese sings in the refrain that, quote, you've got to tolerate all the people that you hate, which you begin to suspect might form a rather long list for these animals.
It's easy when you know how to get along with a bit back now. And if I see you bend up, I'll stop and give you a leg up. Overpriced on real estate, surreal estate. The highest price they've hit today.
Rings Around the World has its share of guest stars. John Cale from the Velvet Underground plays piano on Presidential Suite, which I've read is supposed to be about the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal, but whose lyric is, to my ears, so oblique as to be opaque. Similarly hidden away is Paul McCartney, who is said to chew carrots and celery to the rhythm of a catchy bit of bitterness called Receptacle of the Respectable. Listen closely.
Tell me.
At a time when the American airwaves are full of jolting hip-hop, glossy teen pop, and squawking hard rock, I don't imagine America is waiting to hear Super Furry Animals' pretty indictments of hypocrisy. I don't think I've mentioned that there's a lovely country rock tune mocking violent fundamentalist extremists called Run Christian Run. But just as most of us wouldn't understand what Super Furry Animals was saying were they to sing in their native Welsh, so I prefer to ignore their often foolish, sententious lyrics and enjoy the music they're so obviously super furry talented at making.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Rings Around the World from the Welsh group Super Furry Animals. It will be released in the States in March. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of most Fresh Air programs are available by calling 877-21-FRESH or 877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Matter of Dignity, Changing the Lives of the Disabled, a work of nonfiction by Andrew Potok. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, author of the best-selling book Taliban. His new book, Jihad, is about the rise of militant Islam in Central Asia. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.